Nothing is moving now. There isn't a sound, and the grass is finally in some kind of consensus with the wind. Maybe it's over. The stone that whips past her face comes from above, rings against Rosie's armored flank like a dinner gong. That's what the lull meant. While she was watching the weeds, the kids have taken the high ground. More stones slash and punctuate the air, punch the ground and the trees all around her. Could this get any more fucked up? Foss switches her aim to the leaves overhead and lets off a long, meandering volley. Sorry, squirrels. Anything off the ground is fair game. And here's some good news at last. The turret rotates, and the flamethrower kicks in, drenching the canopy overhead with yellow-white flames. When they get out of this, she's going to have to kiss Sixsmith on the mouth, even if people will talk. The fire catches, and the rain of stones drops off sharply, presumably as the kids find some vantage point where they won't be roasted. Something big and shapeless comes blundering towards her down the slope, and she almost cuts it down before she realizes what it is. It's the robot, weaving like a drunk, carrying Dr. Khan over his shoulder. She looks like she's already dead, but you do what you can. The pelting rain of stones resumes as Greaves lurches past her towards the airlock. Foss locks the Scar H on full auto and gives him a 51mm umbrella. Greaves makes it to the airlock, but then he has to put Khan down so he can cycle the door. Further up the slope, McQueen is on the move again, taking the same route she did. He's walking at a steady, deliberate pace, turning the rifle in a bendy figure of eight to take in the grass and the trees from his 9 o'clock to his 3. Now Colonel Carlyle is coming in too, on Foss's right-hand side. He stops long enough to get a Kimway upright, although the scientist isn't walking properly. 2 dead. Maybe 3. The science team fucking decimated. The colonel was right about staying indoors, and she should have backed his call. None of this had to happen. Greaves has the door open, thank God. He stoops to gather up his burden. Foss fights the urge to run straight for the door. She needs to give the others some cover as they come. She backs towards Rosie's midsection one step at a time, while the colonel and Akimwe converge with McQueen to form a ragged but effective skirmish line. The kids may be wicked little wizards, with their stones and their penknives, but that doesn't mean shit if they can't pop their heads up without getting them blown off. She reaches the airlock, steps up onto the plate, and the door slams shut in her face. She hears the scrape and smack of the latches sliding into their grooves, the hiss of the cycling air. Greaves has locked them out. Chapter 38. Every second counts, so Greaves has been counting them. He is up to 70. He has set a metronome ticking in his mind. He trusts its accuracy, has no need to check a watch, and no time. No time at all. 70 seconds from the moment when Rena was bitten, and 2 minutes is the average time, not the shortest, only the arithmetic mean, that the cordyceps pathogen takes to cross the meningeal barrier and set up house in the brain. 50 seconds, then, before Rena is gone. Set her down. Close and secure the airlock door. 49. He can't let anybody see this. 48. Nobody. 47. The lock is still set to respond to the day code if it is correctly keyed in from outside. Reset the day code. 46. 45. He has to choose a number he will remember so he can let the rest of the team back in once he has done what needs to be done. He chooses pi to 10 places. Too obvious? He cheats and rounds the final 5 down instead of up. 44. 43. 42. He kneels and picks Rena up again. She is convulsing, twisting in his grip. He staggers, almost loses his balance, but manages to right himself again. 41. 40. Sixsmith is in the turret directly above his head. busy. Greaves walks on by without even looking up. The lab can be secured from the midsection by a sliding bulkhead of interlocking plates, but he has to put Rena down again, on the workbench this time, scattering racks and retorts and equipment trays, pushing everything else aside to make room for her. 39, 38, and then before he can deal with the bulkhead, Dr. Fournier comes striding out of the engine room, full of panic and righteous fury. "What's all the noise? Greaves, what are the soldiers firing at? Why?" 37. Greaves charges him full on. Before Fournier knows what's happening, Greaves's lowered head has slammed into his face, and Greaves's forward momentum has pushed him back into the engine room, where he falls and sprawls. 36? Allow one for a skipped beat, lost in that painful impact. 34. Fournier is looking up at him in dazed horror, his face smeared with his own blood. He is mouthing Greaves's name in a slurred and bewildered tone, interrogating the impossible thing that just happened. The engine room isn't really a room, fortunately. It bolts and locks from the outside. Greaves steps back quickly into the lab, slams the door and slides the bolt. 33. 32. Footsteps on the midsection platform. He races across the lab and closes the bulkhead door across, just in time, as Sixsmith comes down the turret ladder, dropping the last few feet onto the platform. 31. 30. 29. The metal reverberates to her pounding. "Greaves, are you fucking insane? What have you done to the door?" No time. No time. He shuts out the noise. Concentrates on the tick of the metronome. 28, draw Rena's blood. 27, try to... 26, try to draw Rena's blood, but she's 25, struggling, fighting him, doesn't... 24, recognize him, so he has to... 23, lean his weight on her. 22, pin her down as her hands... 21, find his face. Push, claw at his face. 20, draw Rena's blood. 20 cc. 19. With one hand, uncap the test tube. 18. The wrong test tube. He needs... 17. The latest batch. Unlabeled. This one. Here. 16. Insert the hypo. Still one-handed. 15. Drop the plunger. Rena's blood mixing... 14. So slowly. 13. With the dead boy's cerebrospinal fluid. 12, and the T-cells of unnamed patient 13631, 11, whose resistance to cordyceps was promising, 10, but who knows, really, 9, draw it back up again, 8, all of it, 7, Rena's hands force his head back, 6, so he's blind, and in his panic the metronome breaks, the ticking stops, his fingers grope and slide and don't find a purchase. He needs a dispersal point in the muscle of her upper shoulder, close, very close to her neck. Intramuscular injection will take advantage of the massive blood flow through that part of the body. Take-up should be instantaneous, and it will have to be, because he's out of time. He stabs down, hits the plunger, drops the untested medicine into a part of Rena's body that he can't even see. Then he gives up the fight, loses his balance and falls. Rena, falling off the table along with him, landing right beside him, face up. She's not moving. Until she opens her eyes, opens her mouth, and screams. Greaves holds her as she shakes. It's not easy for him to be so close to another human body, to feel its alien movement against his own skin. But in her convulsions she might injure herself or kill the baby she's carrying. Eventually she quiets. "Please," he whispers into her ear, in case she can hear him. "Please, please, please don't tell them, Rena." They can't know. Nobody can. Not anybody, not ever. What he has just done. Chapter 39. Sixsmith is nobody's idea of an engineer, but she is far from stupid. With the midsection door out of action, the cockpit will have to stand in. The main problem is that it opens like the door of a truck's cab, occulting about half the visual field as it swings out. Weighing against that, there are doors on both sides. She fires up the engine and brings Rosie around in a half-circle, driving a steel wedge between the beleaguered crew and the little fuckers who appear to be trying, with some success, to kill them all. She throws the near side door open and yells out something that more or less boils down to, "Come and get it!" And one by one they come. Akinwe, limping and sobbing, as pale as a whitewashed wall. Then Foss and McQueen, still firing up into the blazing canopy, even though there is no response from up there now. And finally the Colonel, who doesn't even make a move until everyone else is inside. They don't stay in the cab. It's barely big enough for a driver and a shotgun. One by one they clamber through the glory hole into the crew quarters. Slamming the door shut, Sixsmith guns the engine and relocates at maximum warp. The fire is catching. The whole damn forest is burning down, and the flames will go where the wind carries them. The only sane place to be is way out in front of that. She gets about 2 miles, not even that far, not two, when she blows a track. Chapter 40. By the time Foss makes her way through to the midsection, Greaves has unlocked both the bulkhead door and the engine room. Dr. Fournier is screaming into Greaves's face, his own forehead bearing a bright, dark smear of blood, while Dr. Khan, on the floor, lies sobbing and wheezing for breath. Her long dark hair trails into the pool of vomit she has just deposited there. Her wounded arm has been newly but not neatly dressed. They only just got out of that with their lives, and maybe they should be counting their blessings, but Foss has a sense that things are still coming apart. McQueen strides past her, past the Colonel, pushes Fournier out of the way one-handed, and grabs Greaves's lapels to lift him off the ground and slam him hard against the wall. Then he hauls him back and slams him again, even harder. "Mr. McQueen," Carlyle says, "that's enough." McQueen evidently doesn't agree, because he goes for the hat trick. The robot hits the wall so hard that Foss can feel the vibrations through the steel plates under her feet. Which seems to be the straw that broke the camel's back. The Colonel's handgun is suddenly up against McQueen's ear. McQueen lets go and Greaves slumps, sliding down the wall until he is sitting on the floor. "Discipline is a habit of mind," Carlyle says with deadly calm. "Acquire it. Right now." McQueen stares down at the robot. His teeth are bared and his eyes show very wide. "I want this bastard off the bus," he says hoarsely. "He almost killed us all." Carlyle doesn't look too impressed with this argument. His brow furrows a little and his face flushes red with the effort of self-control. "Actually, I believe that honour belongs to you," he says. "Dr. Khan was talking to the children, negotiating with them. They didn't attack until you shot at them." McQueen turns. He makes a big show of being under the gun, of only holding back because the gun is there. So Carlyle holsters it and holds him with a glare. "There will be a full inquiry," the Colonel says, "when we get back to Beacon. Until that time we are all members of the same crew, and we will behave as though that means something." "Try telling that to this little shit," McQueen says, prodding Greaves with the toe of his boot. "He trapped me in the engine room," Fournier pipes up plaintively. "He assaulted me and locked me inside. Now I can't get any sense out of him. I demand to know what happened out there and where the rest of my crew is." "They're dead," Foss says shortly. She's had about enough of the civilian commander. "They've just lost 3 people, for Christ's sake. And on top of that, Greaves panicked and almost killed them all. And here's Fournier bleating on about his own little bit of lost dignity like that's the salient point." Dr. Khan is trying to climb to her feet. Foss offers her a hand, but she shrugs it off, even though she has to grab hold of a grip rail to stay upright. "Where's John?" she whispers. "Did he make it?" "Seeley's dead," McQueen says. "Penny and Phillips, too. And the rest of us were this close." He holds forefinger and thumb an inch apart, an inch from Greaves's face. "That was when boy genius locked the door on us." "I demand to know," Fournier says again. "Oh, shut the fuck up," Foss interrupts. "If you want to know something, stick your head around the door once in a while and take a look." Fournier swells like a bullfrog, but he doesn't answer, so that's a plus. Khan is stricken. She falls back against the lab bench and almost slides down onto the floor again. Foss doesn't like her much, but she knows that look of blank despair. She has seen it often, both in Beacon and in the times right after the breakdown, before Beacon was a thing. Impulsively, not really knowing why, she puts a hand on Khan's shoulder. "Hey," she says, "be strong. For the baby." Khan looks round at her. She doesn't seem to have got the sense of the words, but the touch calms her a little. At any rate, she stays upright, and her breathing slows a little from the two strokes staccato she had going on there. She's doing her best to hold herself together, Foss thinks, and her best isn't bad. All the same, the doctor keeps blinking as though she's having a hard time bringing the world into focus. There's more yapping. Fournier goes on about insubordination. McQueen goes on about locking the robot up or throwing him out, swinging back and forth between the two options. They're both still reeling from what just happened, Foss sees, and maybe being angry keeps them from thinking about it too much. And all this while, Akinwe is crying as though he's never going to stop. Rosie just rolled to a halt, Foss realizes suddenly. She goes aft to see where Sixsmith has parked them. Right now, looking at the scenery feels like a much better idea than listening to all this bullshit and watching all this heartache. Chapter 41 Rosie has stalled, and the people inside her, likewise. In the face of Khan's grief, which is silent, and Akinwe's hysteria, which is loud and inescapable, Dr. Fournier retreats once more into the engine room. He knows how bad this habit of self-imposed purdah looks to the rest of the crew, especially now, but he needs to get in touch with the Brigadier and tell her what has happened. That the team has suffered a catastrophe. That the hungry pathogen has metastasized in some unforeseen way to produce an entirely new pattern of symptoms, possibly becoming even more dangerous. And that Rosie is carrying the proof, in the form of a valuable and hitherto unseen specimen. He wants the Brigadier to give him permission to come home. What they have just found takes precedence over politics. Surely Fry has to see that. His decision to go overland in the first place quite possibly led directly to this disaster, by slowing them down enough for the feral children to keep pace. Certainly it was a factor in Rosie blowing a track, which is why they're not moving, although there is now so much they need to run away from. Fournier is keenly aware of all this. He feels the weight of the crew's unspoken verdicts. He is the commander, and every call he has made since they turned around and headed for home has been wrong. There is no way for them to know that he has been wrong for the best reasons, on direct orders from the Beacon Muster. This is necessary. All of it. He is on the right side of history, with the blood of three people on his hands. He feels himself surrounded, and it brings him close to panic. He is guilty and ashamed, but he wants to explain to the others the conditionality of his guilt, the unimpeachable ripeness of his disastrous decisions. He can't. He's not allowed to. His mission, his larger mission enfolded in theirs, is ongoing. There may even be more deaths. How can he know? He has leaned out a long way past his center of gravity, and gravity isn't a law you can exempt yourself from. He places his work table against the door, wedging it closed, and calls the Brigadier. Nobody answers. He hits the signal button again and again without hearing anything apart from the infuriating insect chirps of static. The radio has just the one frequency, so he can't tune it. He can't do anything except keep on pressing. Finally, he breaks down and cries, utterly alone in his misery. Even Greaves has Samrina Khan, but he has nobody, no friend or confidant, nobody to justify him in the face of the world. Of course, it's only in Rosie that he is despised, for now. But when they go back to Beacon, it will be the whole world. Everyone will hear how he caused the deaths of a third of his crew. The muster can protect his person, but not his reputation, and the one is scant use without the other. It's not his fault. He is not a free agent. The free agents around him should have done better. A heavy knock on the door makes Fournier start violently. He ducks down to floor level to stow the radio and slip the plate back in place over the hidden recess. It's getting a little crowded in the hidey hole now, because the circuit board from the cockpit radio is in there too. What about his face? Is it obvious that he has been crying? With the heels of his hands, he wipes his cheeks. He straightens, smoothing down his shirt. Yes? Dr. Fournier? It's Carlyle's voice, infuriatingly calm and even. May I come in? Fournier considers the various negative responses. He doubts that any of them will do. He pulls the desk away from the door and opens it. Carlyle steps inside and immediately pushes it closed again. Have we repaired the tread? Fournier asks. Repairing the tread will take hours, and anyone who goes outside to do it will be hard put to protect themselves while they're working. It's broken ground out there with plenty of cover. Still, if we're to get moving again... I'm very much aware of the urgency of the situation, Doctor. That's why I'm here. Fournier steels himself for some accusation or else for a question he can't answer. Decisions need to be made in the wake of what just happened, Carlyle says. The crew are badly shaken up, close to falling apart in some cases, and they need us to show some leadership now. You can't stay in here. No, Fournier agrees. I won't. I just needed to compose myself. But it's important that we agree on a course of action before we go out and speak to them, wouldn't you say? Given where disagreement has got us. Yes, Fournier says. Of course, Colonel. That makes very good sense. Would you like to sit down? He indicates the only chair. He would very much like to claim it for himself because his legs feel weak. But from the perspective of non-verbal signals, body language, that has troubling implications. He doesn't want to look up at Carlyle, who already has the advantage of having been proved right. The Colonel shakes his head. There is a suggestion, he tells Fournier, that we should go back and recover the bodies. It came from Dr. Akinwe, but I suspect Khan and Sixsmith may feel the same way. I said I would consult you before deciding on anything. He winces and shifts his weight. Your leg, Fournier essays, pushing the chair forward a little. Carlyle affects not to see it. My own thinking, he says, is that we need to focus on our own survival. That means fixing the broken tread and then heading straight back to Beacon without any stops along the way. Do you agree? The straight question lands with a thudding impact. Of course Fournier agrees, with every nerve in his body, but his remit from Brigadier Fry runs in exactly the opposite direction. We mustn't act in haste, Colonel, he says. This situation... Yes, we're in a very bad spot, I accept that. We've suffered losses and we're still directly threatened. At risk. Very much at risk. But we've made a hugely important find. Surely it's incumbent on us to assemble as much data as we can before leaving the site. Carlyle's brows dip a little. We've already left the site, he points out, his tone flat. And we have an intact specimen.
Yes, Fournier admits. Yes, of course. But I mean in the wider sense. We need to see how far this new phenomenon has spread. Take measurements and observations. That merits a short delay, I think. A day, perhaps two, no more than that.
Abruptly, Carlyle changes his mind and sits, with a half-stifled sigh. He stares hard at Fournier. Fournier opens his mouth to speak again, but the Colonel makes an impatient gesture that silences him.
This is why I decided to speak to you alone, Carlyle says, still fixing him with that searching gaze.
Doctor, the failure of the ship's intracom wasn't due to any accident or mechanical fault. Private Sixsmith informs me that a component is missing from the cockpit radio, which controls the intracom system as well as maintaining our only link to beacon. Do you know anything about that?
Fournier free-falls for a second before shaking his head vigorously.
No, nothing. But how could that happen? Missing in what sense?
In the sense of it having been removed. It took Sixsmith a long time to discover what was wrong. She had to go back to the schematics.
The missing part is an intermediate frequency transformer, small enough that its absence is hard to spot. But as it turns out, absolutely crucial.
Why would anyone disable the radio? Fournier asks. It sounds like an appropriate question for an innocent man to offer.
I have no idea, the Colonel admits. Possibly the aim was to make sure the radio wasn't used to talk to the outside world, and the failure of the intracom was an unlooked-for side effect, but that's just speculation.
The reason I ask you, Doctor, is because of the timing of all this. The intracom failed shortly after we crashed that barricade back on the road. And I remember that when we were examining Rosie in the aftermath of that incident, you came out to join us via the cockpit door. It's the only time I've ever known you to use it.
It was the quickest way, Fournier exclaims indignantly.
Indignation feels highly plausible.
Good God, I'm under suspicion for choosing the wrong door.
My suspicion is spread fairly evenly at this point.
But surely after today, Greaves has to be the most likely culprit. He clearly can't be trusted. Whether it's some mental aberration or a malicious act intended to...
Fournier stops in mid-sentence. The only intention he can think of is the real one. The Brigadier's, as actioned by him, to prevent you from finding out that there has been a coup d'etat in Beacon, in case you feel called on to interfere.
Carlyle shrugs.
I'm making no accusations. I asked you purely because I know you had the opportunity.
As to the motive, well, I presume we can agree that it falls under the broad heading of sabotage.
Reluctantly, Fournier nods. He doesn't like the Colonel's choice of words. People get shot for sabotage. He thinks he has been discreet, but being a double agent in an enclosed space is an insanely demanding discipline. He can't be sure he has left no clues behind him.
And if it was sabotage, Carlyle continues, whoever carried it out wanted us to be unable to talk to Beacon.
I can imagine some circumstances in which that would be an issue.
All of them are extreme and unlikely, but then so is the prospect of a saboteur in this crew.
He is still examining Fournier's face as he says this, with minute and clinical interest. Fournier does his best to look concerned, affronted, and honest.
How does this bear on our current situation? He asks at last.
Carlyle shifts his weight in the chair, wincing again.
I should have thought that was obvious, he says. If someone wants us to stay incommunicado, then we have to return to Beacon as quickly and directly as we can.
Your suggestion that we explore further makes no sense to me, especially in our weakened condition.
We're short-handed. Some of the crew are traumatized, and for all we know, the feral children are still pursuing us,
They seem to be outside the normal human range for both strength and speed, just as the Hungries are. It seems very likely that they are Hungries, of a new and unidentified kind. It's imperative that we stay ahead of them, and it's imperative that we return to Beacon in one piece to deliver what we've discovered. You understand me? You make a strong case, Fournier allows. But still, in the interests of... Doctor, Carlyle cuts in, the question was not, do you agree, but do you understand? I'm not negotiating with you. I'm explaining to you what we are going to do. I expect you to go out there now and tell the crew that this is a decision we've reached together. If you feel unable to do so, I'm going to shoot you in the head and tell them myself. Fournier laughs at the absurdity of this image, but it stops being funny as he takes in the colonel's somber tone and the solemn, unhappy set of his face. He means it. Are you mad? Fournier gasps. Possibly, the colonel says, but I don't believe so. At any rate, I'm fully cognizant of what I'm doing, and I'll take full responsibility for it. I intend to get this crew back to Beacon alive. If you propose any course of action that exposes them to further danger, you make yourself an active threat, in which case killing you becomes the least of several evils. But, appalled, Fournier tries to cling to rationality. You can't just threaten me like that. I don't do it lightly, Doctor. When we get back to Beacon, you can report that I coerced you and threatened you with violence. I won't contradict you. In the meantime, of course, it will have to be our secret. As I've already told you, I don't want to compromise morale when it's at such a low ebb. We share this command. I have as much right as you to say what the mission is. Up to now, yes. Not any more. The colonel draws his field pistol from its holster and lays it across his lap. He waits in silence, presumably for Fournier to decide between death and surrender. There is a middle ground, though, whatever the colonel thinks. Fournier can say whatever he needs to say to get out of this room and then go back on it. Carlyle won't dare to kill him in front of the crew. Which means, of course, that he won't dare to do it here in the engine room either. The closed door hides nothing. If he shoots Fournier, everyone will hear the shot. Everyone will know it was murder. I'm sorry, Colonel, the doctor says. I won't be threatened or dictated to. I have the right to express my own opinions, and the right to enforce them as civilian commander. Very well, then, Carlyle says. He runs his left hand across the side of the handgun. There is a single click, soft and discreet, but full of sinister import. He stands without a word. Wait! Fournier blurts. Carlyle presses the barrel of the handgun against the side of the doctor's head. Fournier's eyes close involuntarily against the flash and ruin that's about to come. His knees give and he sinks to the floor. He raises his hands to wrest the gun from the colonel's hands, but he leaves them up in a gesture of abject submission. Don't, he pleads. I don't want to, the colonel says again. But the gun doesn't move from Fournier's temple. I want us to come out of this intact, with no further loss of life. Work with me, Doctor, until we get home, at least. After that, you can do as you like. Fournier can taste bile in his mouth. He thinks he might be about to vomit, which would make his humiliation complete. I'll work with you, he says, the words thick and oily in his mouth. I promise. The cold pressure at his forehead goes away. Thank you, Carlyle says. You are sure, Dr. Fournier, that you don't have that missing radio component? If you did, we could contact Beacon right now. Make a full report and get our orders direct. The report would, of course, include the conversation we've just had. I won't try to stop you from laying a formal complaint against me. Fournier climbs weakly to his feet. He feels strange and distant from himself, tingling and prickling with dread and nausea. That makes it easier to lie. Nobody could read his body language now when it's slack and sick and strange even to him. "I don't know what happened to the radio," he says. "Very well. But we're agreed about the mission?" "Yes, Colonel. We're agreed. And I'll make my report in my own way, in my own time."
"Then that's all that matters for the present. Thank you. I'll give you some time to compose yourself, Doctor. 10 minutes? Then I'll convene the crew." Chapter 42.
There is a meeting in the crew quarters to which everyone except Stephen Greaves is summoned. He is the spectre at the feast, Khan thinks, only a few feet away but invisible, sitting on his bunk with the curtains drawn, present and absent at the same time. He has changed into his blue cotton pyjamas, as though this is his bedtime, and withdrawn into himself in the way he often does. The rest of the crew have pulled up their drawbridges, too, in ways that are only marginally less obvious. Greaves might as well be in another country. Foss has been patched in from the turret via the short-range walkie-talkies since the ship's intercom is still shot. Khan is present, too, for some value of that word. Mostly she is aware of the tides of her own blood and her own emotions, while the conversation rolls around and over her. She is still human. The moment when she was bitten plays on a continuous loop in her brain, vivid and terrifying. But it must be an illusion, a trauma artifact. She must have been stabbed, or scratched, or sliced, or else something scraped against her open wound and caused that sharp spike of pain. She has managed to evade the literally once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to study the hungry pathogen very briefly from the inside. All the same, something is very wrong. Under the bandage, her skin is alive, crawling, as though it wants to migrate to some other part of her. Her head is heavy and hot. Her stomach, too, an oven baking her dry. When she cried for John, which she did long and hard, no tears came from her eyes. Everybody by this time has made the pilgrimage to the lab's freezers and inspected the tiny corpse in Cabinet 10. Everybody has accepted that it is what Greaves says it is, one of the hungry children they just encountered, the children who all but slaughtered them from a standing start, despite the adults' massive superiority in weapons and training. If they had only known, John might be alive. And Penny. And Phillips. Khan has always been able, up to now, to make allowances for how Stephen thinks, how he behaves, and she knows he tried his best to tell them his secret. But for now, and for the first time ever, she finds it hard to look at him, or to think kindly of him. Words wash around her. Meanings follow at their own pace, or some of them do. She is not always at home to take delivery. Akinwe argues for going back. His lover, Private First Class Gary Phillips, is among the dead. He asserts over and over again that they can't just leave him there. Leave them all there, like rubbish dumped along the road. John is there too, Khan thinks. I should feel the same way Akinwe feels. But she doesn't. When she thinks of John Seeley, she thinks of their bodies pressed together between the upper and middle bunks, the narrow space that they defended against the world. That's important. The scientist in her insists on it. Her memories are John's mortal remains, and that roadside carrion is nothing. But the living owe a duty to the dead. Even the feral children know that. That's why they ran and ran in Rosie's wake all the way from Invercray. They want their brother, their friend, their own, to be returned to them, which is exactly what Akinwe wants. She sees it all in that moment, everything that's happening and has to happen. But it slips away again. Her mind won't make a fist to hold it in. So it is left to Dr. Fournier to explain how important the specimen in Freezer 10 is, how unique it is. McQueen scoffs at that word. How can it be unique when they're surrounded by the evil little fuckers? And it's true that Fournier's words ring a little hollow right now. In fact, everything about him is hollow. He looks like a cardboard cutout of himself stood up as a point-of-sale display in the days when smiling faces sold things. Not that he's smiling. The children are, or seem to be, something completely new, he tells the silent room. They are infected, but they can still think. Properly focused research might be able to pinpoint the mechanism involved and then duplicate it, to find a cure or a vaccine. This is the single most important discovery anyone has made since the breakdown began. Fournier speculates, briefly, on what the children might be. The offspring of women who were already pregnant when they were infected, or else the children of atypical hungries who retained some human drives apart from feeding. Second generation, almost certainly. The cordyceps pathogen has to have been mediated through something in order to explain these functional and structural changes, and the most likely candidate is a placenta. Khan feels a vibration, as Fournier says that word, from the depths of her own abdomen. It feels for a moment as though Rosie is still moving, but it's just her. A freight train with a single carriage, a single passenger, destination still unknown. Fournier seems to have realized at last how little anyone cares about his speculations. He pulls himself together and sums up quickly. They have to get the sample, the child from Invercray, back to Beacon along with their report. The scientific effort that is needed now will involve dozens or hundreds of researchers and years of time. And that work can't start until they get their specimen home. With the radio out, they can't even let the main table know what they've found. They have to bring the sample back, or everything they have done will be wasted. It's quite a long speech. Dr. Fournier makes it, for the most part, with his eyes down, staring at the steel latticed floor. But when he has finished, he looks at Colonel Carlyle, just once, as if he is searching for approval or agreement in the Colonel's eyes. Foss, over the walkie-talkie, says thank you. She says she likes to know what she's shooting, especially when it's cuter than kittens. She adds that if they're ever going to get started on those fucking treads, they've got maybe an hour or so of daylight left. McQueen says he doesn't think daylight is going to make much difference. They've got the spotlights and all the kit. The trouble is that as soon as they step outside the doors, all hell is probably going to break loose again. They're stuck here for the duration, which might mean until they're all dead. Right now he is more concerned with the question of what they're going to do with Greaves, only he doesn't say Greaves, he says the robot. He offers some suggestions. The mildest is that they shove Greaves out of the airlock and leave him to die. Another, not the most extreme, involves a bayonet. The Colonel states without inflection that he has written up Stephen's actions and will refer them for adjudication and punishment as soon as they're back in Beacon. McQueen says that's not good enough. Akinwe agrees, and the whole room tenses for a confrontation that seems to have been a very long time in coming. It's awful. All of this is awful. But Khan feels as though she is watching it through the wrong end of a telescope. At the same time, everything is too close, too confined. Rosie is full of the rank sourness of human bodies pressed and rolled against each other like cheese in a vat. Every time she inhales, the smell hits the back of her nose, tickles and scorches there. John is dead. And there is nothing left that isn't burning to the ground. Except her baby. Except that little sliver of life that caught in her and quickened. "He saved me," she whispers. She clears her throat and says it again, louder. They're the first words she has spoken. Everybody looks at her and she holds up her bandaged arm. "Stephen saved me, after I was hurt." "That's beside the point," McQueen says. "Not to me. He almost killed the rest of us." "Well, you did that first," Khan points out. "You shot one of them without even looking at what was happening.
and everything went to hell. We were fine up until then. And, by the way, you should know that unless we leave that body here for them to find, they'll keep coming after us.
That's what this is about. That's what it's been about all along.
And who brought the damn thing on board in the first place? McQueen demands. Thanks, you've made my point. It's way past time we stopped talking about this and just fucking dealt with it.
The ex-lieutenant seems to be all done with words.
He stands up slowly, making a big deal out of it. We need a little leadership here, he says. That little tosser hung us out to dry, and he probably spiked the radio too. Now, are you going to show him the door, or do I have to do it myself?
With a heavy sense of inevitability, Khan finds a fork, the only sharp implement on the table, and grabs a hold of it with her good left hand. She is so tired and so sick, she would much rather just sit here. But if McQueen is going to square off against the Colonel to decide Stephen's fate, then he's going to do it with three tines lodged in his kidney. But Stephen breaks the tableau. He pulls the curtains of his bunk aside and peers out at them, as though all this time he has only been waiting for his cue. His face is pale, and his eyes are wide, but his tone when he speaks is calm and precise. He says, "I'm happy to go outside. I was actually going to suggest it." And then, although Khan thinks she must have misheard this part, "I'll need to put my suit on."
Chapter 43 Private Sixsmith is not a good teacher, Greaves thinks. She locates and assembles the hydraulic track puller and drills him in its use, but she omits several pieces of information that he considers crucial. One, she doesn't tell him that the Rosalind Franklin has live rather than dead track, held under tension by the rubber brushings in each track block, so there is less risk of a throw as it passes over the return rollers. If he didn't know this already, he would expect the treads on the upper span to be under lower tension than those on the ground span. Two, she tells him to set the puller to deliver 1,800 mechanical horsepower, the maximum it will output. This is only appropriate if the brake is in the middle of a span and must be adjusted depending on the distance from the return rollers. Three, she omits to mention that Greaves will need to replace the existing connectors on the intact blocks adjacent to the damaged ones. Even if they look sound, they may be stressed in the plane of the existing brake. Fitting new blocks to mounts that have been stressed in this way will practically guarantee another track throw. As it happens, none of these omissions causes Greaves any practical difficulties. He read the track puller's manual from cover to cover on the second week out from Beacon. He read the manuals for all the onboard equipment, even the ones that were already familiar to him from Rena's lab. Still, it's useful to see a live demonstration, and in this respect he has no complaints to make about Sixsmith's instructions. She shows him how to position the pump, and the safest angle from which to fire the tapping bit. These are useful things to know, and the manual did not explicitly address them. A few wars ago, this was a four-man job, Sixsmith tells him. Tanker bar, cheetah pipe, the whole frigging wardrobe. Even now I don't envy you doing it alone. The puller makes it possible, but it doesn't make it easy. Thank you, Private Sixsmith, Greaves says meekly. I'll do the best I can.
And you're sure you don't want to take a gun?
We are not, McQueen says, giving this fucking retard a gun.
Greaves doesn't answer, since McQueen's response has made his own unnecessary. He absolutely does not want a gun. He won't have either of his hands free to carry a weapon, and he wouldn't be able to use one in any case. He read all the manuals for the guns and rifles too, of course, but only in order to understand their functioning, not because he ever seriously thought about firing one. They all watch as he puts on the suit. Its existence seems to make Dr. Fournier very angry, though he says nothing. Perhaps he feels that he is the only one on board who should be allowed to keep secrets from the others. Perhaps secrets are meant to be a privilege of rank. That is grotesque, McQueen says, shaking his head. Greaves tries to explain that form follows function. The principle is heat diffusion via the placement of...
I don't want to know the principle, fuckwit. I just want you to get out there and do the job.
Or get yourself eaten, so we know where we stand. Dr. Khan is not present. She has pronounced herself unwell and taken to her bunk. Greaves had thought she might try to dissuade him from going outside, but she seems to be having difficulty at the moment focusing her mind on her surroundings. When he saw her last, as she withdrew, her face was flushed and she had a visible tremor in her hands. Greaves frets. What are these things a symptom of? Just shock or something worse? Has his cure, or rather his desperate ad hoc workaround, been effective? Or has it failed? If the latter, the infection could become active again at any moment. But he can't help her unless he goes outside and acquires what he needs. That's the whole point of volunteering to repair the broken tread. Lie. Liar. Not the whole point. There's something else he needs to do. Will risk his life to do, although he has no idea why it matters so much. It ought not to matter at all. He pulls on the face mask and hood with a sense of relief. If they can't see his face, they can't see his thoughts. Here you go, you little lunatic. Sixsmith says this without heat, almost with respect. She hands him, one by one, the track puller, the slender cylinder of compressed air in its shoulder sling, and the toolbox. I'd like my sampling kit, too, Greaves mumbles. Please? McQueen rolls his eyes, but they humour him. They think he is sticking to a routine, just for the comfort it brings. They think, as always, that they understand him. Acting Lieutenant Foss brings the kit, and Greaves clips it to his belt, which he has deliberately worn on top of the heat dispersal suit. Then Foss opens up the inside door of the airlock for him, and he steps in. Greaves is used to missing the signals other people send with their faces, and making up the lost information in other ways. But he sees the moment when Dr. Akinwe looks away. Dr. Akinwe blames him for the death of Private Phillips, whom he loved. He knows, of course, that Private Phillips died before Greaves sealed the midsection door. But the logic that is operating here is not a simple linear one. Guilt and innocence are tangled up in each other, elided. Foss drops back as Carlyle steps up, taking her place at the airlock controls. Are you sure you want to do this, Stephen? The Colonel asks. Stephen nods. He's very sure, and very grateful for the vagueness of the word, this. He is sure of what he wants to do, and has no wish at all to explain it. Be careful, the Colonel says, and come back inside at the first sign of movement. He knows Greaves well enough not to try to touch him, but he gives him a nod of reassurance and perhaps acknowledgement. Then he closes the inner door. Greaves is committed now. Inside the mask he smiles, because of the certainty. Because being committed means a reduction of randomness, a paring down of possibilities. It will be hard, and he might die. But it's good to have a clear through line, and to depend on nothing but his own abilities. The outer door opens. He steps through it. It is very dark at first. The moon has filled out a little since his last night walk, but rags of clouds are racing across the sky, so it comes and goes. He is alone in the night, as far as he can tell. All the rest of the crew are inside the hull. They can't see him or interact with him. Sixsmith had tried to fit him with a radio microphone, but had given up when she saw how tightly the mask and hood fitted him. A mic that broke one of the suit's seals would be worse than useless. Because from another point of view, he is far from alone. The children are out here somewhere, possibly very close. Greaves has stepped out of his own world into theirs. At night, he knows, they can only see heat. Their sight in the visible spectrum is no better than his, so the suit will disguise him. But it won't muffle the noise he makes as he works, which will be considerable. His best hope, or perhaps his only hope, is that the fire started by Rosie's flamethrower has forced them to relocate. He addresses himself to the repairs. This is the first time he has ever used any of these tools, but their operation is simple and the task has an algorithmic structure that appeals to him. Locate the damaged tread blocks. There are only two, which is good. Break the track by knocking out the end connectors on their inside and outside edges. The puller has a tapping bit attachment, like a blunt-ended road drill specifically for this. The bit is powered by the gas cylinder and delivers a colossal amount of power to an area perhaps 2 square inches in cross-section. It feels to Greaves as though he's swinging a sledgehammer without having to raise it. The recoil frightens him a little, but the connectors pop away with almost no resistance. Replace the damaged blocks with whole ones. He has brought 10 and uses 4, swapping out both the damaged blocks and their nearest neighbour on either side. Attach the puller's clamps to the 2 loose ends of the track, then set the main gauge to 1,500 horsepower, which he has judged by eye to be sufficient. The hydraulics go to work as he operates the pump, dragging the broken ends together under higher and higher tension, until at last they are where they need to be. The puller is now holding the tread together like a fingertip on a knot. Fit new end connectors, again using the tapping bit. And release the puller. This is far and away the most dangerous part. If he has miscalculated the tension, the tread will snap, and he will be standing right in front of it, perfectly positioned to be slapped across the face with a gauntlet of modular steel plates, moving at 80 to 100 meters per second. He is not misjudged. The puller slides free and the tread holds. Greaves's inner clock tells him he has been out here for 40 minutes. Lacking any visual confirmation of the extent of the damage, Sixsmith has estimated that repairs would most likely take around 3 hours. Greaves resets the notional timer with a half-painful prickling of tension. He has told nobody what he intends to do now. He has allowed them to believe that he will finish repairing the tread and then return immediately to the airlock. But he hasn't actually told a lie. That Rubicon glistens in the dark in front of his eyes, still and deep and treacherous. Greaves puts down the puller, the cylinder, the toolbox. He walks away from Rosie into the dark and the silence, following one of the 2 flattened paths left by the vehicle's treads. This is wilderness, uneven and unpredictable, but the going is relatively easy as long as he sticks to the path. He makes good progress. After 30 minutes, he is back among the trees. He can feel the residual heat from that afternoon's fire, but the smell doesn't reach him. He wonders whether it would include scorched flesh as well as charred wood and vegetable matter. He wonders whether he has come here on a fool's errand. But the bodies are intact. The flamethrower was pointed at the canopy, and the east wind spread the blaze away to the west, leaving them untouched. And the living children, as far as he can see, have not yet returned to claim their dead. Greaves sits and waits until the moon comes out from the scudding clouds, letting him see to work. 7 of the children died in the afternoon's encounter. He draws off cerebrospinal fluid from each of them, inserting his sampling needle into the subarachnoid space between the 3rd and 4th lumbar vertebrae. He fills every vial in his kit. He will need as much CSF as he can get. He thinks that if he is going to die tonight, it will be now, as he robs the dead. If any of the children are watching, they will be full of outrage and vengeful fury. But he can't let that stop him. There is too much at stake. Rena. Rena is at stake. Also, there is the other thing. The smaller thing. But not so small now that he is looking down at the small, curled bodies. He checks to see that the scarred girl is not there. He wants her to be still alive. He looks at each face in turn as he works. Not her. 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 His chest, where she kicked him back at the water testing plant, aches a little. It's as though they are still touching.